this is what the elites didn't understand, and still some of the elites in the Muslim world don't understand. They think that if the Americans say that they're good, that means they're good. And I'm specifically referring, for example, let's say, just as an example, you know, the gentleman in Turkey today.
A gentleman in Turkey, right. Yes. I thought we were going in that direction.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
who claim to be Islamic and who have their nice little Islamic mustaches, but you know, they're just waiting for the Americans to pat
them on the back.
Right. And so this is a problem, you know, and this was a major problem in Iran, and Imam broke all of that. Here he was on his own terms, which were God's terms, and, you know, as the flag bearer, as the standard bearer, as the leader of this movement, which was, you know, a divine movement and for Islam, saying, you know, the truth is here in Islam.
Islam.
Don't be ashamed of it. You know, use it.
Be proud of being Muslim.
This is the thing that God gave you so that you could advance, and it gave it to all of humanity. And he, you know, he was not a racist person. He was not a person.
No.
He loved humanity. He wanted everybody to benefit from it. He was never saying to non-Iranians or non-Muslims that you shouldn't have. He said, this is for all of us, because he understood humanity as one.
Right.
This is why, for example, he sends the letter to Gorbachev at that time.
Well, we'll speak more about that in another session. But thanks very much, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for your contribution today on the man who changed the world. Of course, there's so much to say. But it just leaves me to say for the moment, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for listening today. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Hello and welcome back to The Light. A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic, colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming has used clay to make a sculpture of an ox, this year's symbol in the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It's almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says, the piece aims to lift spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It's adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says he will put the ox in the public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around North America to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, around Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rothwell has sailed all over the world, including 3 previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at the time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Some might say pandas are natural born celebrities, and they are right. In China's Sichuan province, 10 panda cubs have made their first public debut, with throngs of journalists and photographers watching their every move. All of the adorable creatures, which are not named yet, were born in 2020 at a Wolong Conservation and Research Center. Their age ranges from just 120 to 190 days. Each of the cubs has a weight of about 10 kilograms. Over the past year, a total of 44 panda cubs were born around the globe.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading under bridges, buildings and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
An American artist has committed himself to drawing 50,000 bees on buildings around the world. Matthew Willey, who has painted murals for 25 years, came up with the idea after a bee buzzed into his room. His goal is to raise awareness about saving the little fuzzy insects. 50,000 is the number of bees in a healthy, thriving hive in nature. During the past 5 years, Willey has painted over 5,500 of the insects in 30 murals.
My goal has always been to be in every type of neighborhood in the world. So that would be all of the continents, all of, you know, I can't literally paint bees in every community, but to take a cross section and say, you know, in every type of place, these bees have been painted, because I'm really, even though it is a healthy hive of bees that visually will be painted, it's really us. I'm painting the human race into this collective hive.
Willey says many people have so far supported his project with their donations. He hopes that his murals prompt people to rethink their relationship with nature. Bees and other insects are constantly facing a range of threats, from the use of pesticides to habitat loss and climate change.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The U.S. federal government, as part of its $2 trillion coronavirus relief package approved in March, significantly expanded jobless aid, making it a richer target for fraud. By November, the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Inspector General estimated states had paid as much as $36 billion in improper unemployment benefits, with a significant proportion of that blamed on fraud. In California alone, officials say the fraud totaled at least $11 billion, with $810 million paid in the names of ineligible prisoners. We have prepared for you an article written by Adam Bean. The piece is titled Tax Forms Help Reveal Extent of Unemployment Fraud in United States. The article has been taken from the Associated Press news agency. Please stay with us for more of Adam Bean's article. Unemployment agencies across the United States became lucrative targets for criminals when they were bombarded with claims last year as millions lost jobs due to the coronavirus shutdowns. Now, simple tax forms being sent to people who never collected unemployment benefits are revealing that their identity was likely stolen months ago and used to claim bogus benefits that have totaled billions of dollars nationwide. Unemployment benefits are taxable, so government agencies send a 1099-G form to people who receive them so they can report their income on their tax returns. States are mailing 1099-Gs in huge numbers this year after processing and paying a record number of claims. In Ohio, Bernie Irwin was shocked 2 weeks ago when she opened the mail and found a 1099-G form saying her husband had claimed $17,000 in unemployment benefits last year. The only problem? Her husband, Jim Irwin, an 83-year-old, hadn't worked in 13 years. Bernie Irwin, 86, said her daughter-in-law and a friend also received the tax forms. So did Republican Governor Mike DeWine, his wife Fran, and Republican Lieutenant Governor John Husted, even though none of them had claimed unemployment benefits. Nearly 26 million people requested unemployment aid in the initial months after states began ordering shutdowns. The unprecedented surge strained unemployment offices that are governed by federal rules but administered in patchwork fashion by state governments, with many relying on 1960s-era software to process applications and issue payments. The federal government, as part of its $2 trillion relief package approved in March, significantly expanded jobless aid, making it a richer target for fraud. By November, the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Inspector General estimated states had paid as much as $36 billion in improper benefits, with a significant portion of that blamed on fraud. In California alone, officials say the fraud totaled at least...
This is IRIB English Radio, special coverage.
The resounding victory of the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people over the oppressive Pahlavi regime. The day was the 11th of February 1979, but this year it falls on the 10th of February, since last year was a leap year. The victory of the Islamic Revolution put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. Dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program and go live to Press TV headquarters, where we have a series of discussions, panels, and interviews on the 42nd anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution in Iran. Let's take a listen.
Going back to the history of this revolution and how it started and why it started, the people of Iran, they have a great history. And for close to 2,500 years, they were living under the monarchy of different kings, corrupt kings who did not care about anything except their own wealth and their own family. And they just used people to become more and more powerful. They used the resources of this country. But this kingdom went down to the level that Pahlavis became the kings of Iran. And, well, they were not only merely kings of Iran. They were puppets of Western and Eastern powers. Well, at that time, Western powers. So they were just giving whatever the Iranian people had to the other side. They were just listening and following the policies and to the policies of the Western leaders. And, well, the people of Iran, in terms of their economy, they were weak at that time. In terms of justice, they did not have justice. In terms of education, in terms of health care and issues, they did not have anything at that time. And in terms of freedom in their beliefs and, you know, practicing their religion freely, they also did not have anything and any freedom. So all of this pressure on the Iranian people, all of this pressure led to them going back to their scholars, mm-hmm. going back to what the scholars have always been calling for, and that was the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini lived between the people. He knew what the problem is exactly. He, when you read about his life, every Thursday for a certain period of time, he used to go to poor areas of his city, wherever he lived, to just be with the people and see what the problems are and what the needs of the people are and how to help the people achieve their goals. Therefore, Imam Khomeini came from within this society. He knew the pains and problems of the society, and he stood against the government of Shah.
Well, let me just stop you right there, because we're talking about, you talked about the oppression, the repression that was taking place, and you talked about leaders who basically felt that they were above the people, separate from the people. And that could probably be said about most of the regimes in this area during that time, and even for many of them still today. So what made the situation in Iran different that we saw this revolution take place and be successful?
Mohammad Hassanein Haykel is an Egyptian journalist. He has a book. In his book, he makes a comparison between the Iranian revolution and other revolutions in this region. He says, why is it that when Imam Khomeini comes and he invites people to follow him and fight against the government of Shah, which was the strongest regime in this region, or one of the strongest regimes backed by the so-called superpowers of that time, why is it that the people follow him and they manage to achieve their goals? Yet at the same time, other people, they did not achieve this victory. Mm-hmm. The difference is this, that the relationship between the people and their leader in Iran is such that makes them capable of achieving this victory and bringing about a new order to this region.
What does that mean?
And that is the Shia Islam system that Imam Khomeini had, the true Islam, the real Islam, that is fighting for justice. And people are willing to give their lives for their leaders in the sense of, because they know they're following the prophets. It's not just, you know, some sort of a label that, okay, this guy is a leader and I have to follow him. No, this guy is a representative of the prophets between them. So when he speaks, it's just like the prophet is speaking. When he speaks, he is the successor of a prophet, and as we the Shia say, he's the successor of the successor of the prophet, the imam of the Shias. Therefore,
the power that he has, the inner connection that he has in his heart to people. When he says something, people are willing to give their lives for whatever he says to happen. And people know how he lived and how he lives. And when they see that he's honest, he's trustworthy, he believes himself in whatever he says. When he says, I believe in God and I put my trust in God, and I'm going to fight against the government of Shah, which is backed by all the superpowers of the world, and I'm just a single scholar in Qom, and I'm not afraid. If they want to kill me, let them kill me. If they want to arrest me and torture me, let them do so. We know the history of the regime of Shah. You know that we know the history of what happened in their prisons, how they tortured people. They had people coming from the Germany and America and Israel training officials here to torture people and to do different things. Yet Imam Khomeini and his followers, they said, if you want to torture us, but we're not going to give up.
Right. So. The victory takes place, the revolution comes about, and we have seen, I would say, for the whole 42 years, challenges and attacks, and also a lot of prognosis saying that the revolution would not last. I remember in the very beginning, and they were saying it won't last 6 months.
Yeah.
And then it was a year, and it just continued to expand it. And even today, when different situations happen, for example, if we have protests in Iran like any other country, then again, it's like it's finished.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the key to this longevity that the revolution mm-hmm. has lasted?
First of all, Imam Khomeini did not, although he was a Shia scholar, he did not limit his revolution to Shias. Although he was a Muslim scholar, he did not limit his revolution to Islam. He said that this revolution is the revolution of the poor and the needy and the oppressed of the world. So from the beginning, from the early days of his movement, he said, my first issue and my first priority is the issue of Palestine. When you're tying your revolution to these concepts that, okay, I care about Iran and the needs of the Iranian people, but I also look at the other side of the borders
mm-hmm.
and I see injustice and oppression in other parts of the world. You make the people of those regions, of those countries, and you make all the oppressed people of those countries connected to your revolution.
Which is quite amazing, actually, if we look at a post-revolutionary country
yes.
with all the problems, and then for Imam to talk about Palestine from the very beginning.
At that time, with all the pressure that Imam had, and was on the system and the government of Iran after the revolution, Imam says that my first issue, the first priority is the issue of Palestine, and the Palestine has to go back to Palestinians, and they have to decide for their own country. So this way, you make people and all the oppressed people connected to your country. It's interesting to see that when Saddam Hussein attacks Iran, and during the war, the Iran-Saddam war, and I don't call it Iran-Iraq war, it wasn't a war between Iran and Iraq, it was a war between Iran and Saddam attacked Iran by the order of the so-called superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
When you see this, you see that people from all around the world, different countries, they sign up to come and fight and defend Iran. They don't think Iran is their own country, yet they think this revolution is their own revolution. Despite the fact that this is another country, but this revolution belongs to us as well. I was talking to one of my friends in the UK, and he said, before this revolution, we always felt like we were the minority in the world, and the rich and the lobbies of the rich, they get to do whatever they want. Until a time that Islamic revolution happened in Iran, and we felt like now we have a strong wall behind us that can protect us. We're under the protection of the Islamic revolution, and this is what has been happening after the victory of the Islamic revolution in 1979. So one point is that Imam Khomeini connected his revolution to the people of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that Imam Khomeini relied on the promise of Allah and the promise of God. God says, if you come to my path and if you're honest and if you do what I tell you, if you're submissive towards my orders, I will support you, I will protect you. Imam Khomeini says, although I'm alone, but I have Allah's, God's protection on me and on my people. And who's his people? Whoever follows him will be considered as his people, wherever they are. So, despite the fact that all the superpowers want to get rid of him, it's interesting when you go to the documents we found in the American embassy in Iran after these students, you know, took over the embassy. Mm-hmm. You see clear evidence that they've been trying to prevent this revolution to happen, meaning that okay, the will of this people is for this revolution to happen. But Americans, the British government, Israelis, and all these so-called superpowers at that time, imperialism, they were trying to prevent this revolution to happen. They were trying to make obstacles. And after the victory, they were still trying to, you know, get rid of this revolution. But right. They were unsuccessful. They remained unsuccessful, and they will remain unsuccessful, inshallah.
With what you said about Imam Khomeini and connecting it to Palestine and condemning what the Israelis have done from the very beginning and usurping the land of the Palestinians, and not only that, we see very much an international aspect to the revolution that started then and continues today. Would you say that that is one of the top reasons why those who are against the revolution, especially we're talking about the hegemons of the time, mm-hmm. that is one of their biggest fears? Because what has happened is that Iran, just in example and what it has done, has greater and greater and greater influence mm-hmm. in the region and in the world, to be honest. How big of a threat is that okay. to the hegemon?
See, if we want to talk about the impact of the Islamic Revolution, mm-hmm. we divide it to three different parts. The impact of this revolution on the people of this country, the impact of the Islamic Revolution on the people of this region, and the impact of this revolution on the people of other regions, on the people of the world. The impact of this Islamic Revolution on the people of this region and other regions was such that all the leaders of the world felt scared about it. Why? Because if you learn to say no to an oppressor, and if you call other people to say no to oppressors, they will learn that they can disobey the oppressors and they can stand up for their rights and they can fight for their rights. This is the core reason why they're afraid of this government, of this system, of this people, because the people of Iran, this revolution has been teaching the people of the world that you should not tolerate the oppression of the oppressors. You should stand up, you should fight, you should speak up. And this is what the people of this region and people of the world have been doing. And that's why they're afraid, because once the people realize that they can fight for their rights, once the people realize who the real friend and who the real enemy is, at that time, these so-called superpowers, they lose everything. And let me just give you one example. Last year, Trump said that we've spent $7 billion, $7 trillion in this region. Yet, when I want to come to this region, I have to come at night, and when we want to land, we have to keep the lights off, because this is how the people of this region are. We've spent so much money, so much time, we've planned so much to control this region, to control the resources of this region, to make the people of this region follow us through different plans, through the power of their propaganda and media. Yet when I want to come to this region, I have to come at night with the lights off. But when you see the Iranian officials go to different countries in this region, I mean, these days you can see in news, Ayatollah Raisi is in Iraq, and he's visiting Iraq, and you see how people of Iraq welcomed him with open arms and good hospitality. Or when the former president of Iran went to Lebanon, how they welcomed him over there. and let the president of America come to the streets of Iraq, come to the streets of Beirut, come to the streets of, say, Kabul, into this region, mm-hmm. and see how, what people do to him. It's because they've learned who the enemy is, they've learned who the oppressors are, and they know the smile on their face is just a makeup. They know it's just a game. They know when they smile at you, they have the gun hidden in their pocket and they're ready to shoot. So
with what you're saying, let me just pick up with what you just mentioned about Trump and the $7 trillion. So an entity like the United States is spending the money and obviously not getting the results that they want. Why don't they change tactics? Why don't they change?
See, we have a tradition that says, حب الدنيا يعمي ويسن. The love for this dunya makes people deaf, okay, and blind. You're so eager and desperate to achieve something, and you know if you don't achieve it, you're going to lose everything. They want to take control of this region and the resources of this region. And they know if they don't take control of this region, that'll be the end of it, because they lose power and other, you know, systems will become more powerful. That's just one aspect of it, though. This is the nature of imperialism. This is the nature of Zionism today, which is the same as imperialism in the tactics today. So once they know this, they just have to go forward. They can't go backward. Going backwards is just like saying, okay, we were wrong, and we're bad people, and we're evil. No, when they come on media, they say, in God we trust. But God knows the only thing they trust is evil. They trust in evil. Let me mention a quote from Obama. Mm-hmm. He has a book. He wrote about, you know, everything he did in a diary, and in this book he says whenever the politicians or the so-called decision makers of our system come to my office and talk to me when I was president and talk to me about the fact that the only and last solution to overcome this issue in this region, meaning the issue of the Islamic revolution, is to attack them. I feel like maybe that's the last solution, mm-hmm. and that's the only solution. But as they leave, I feel sorry, because I know if we go for that solution, that means the end of American dream. That means the end of everything that we've tried to build. They cannot control the will of this people. No one can control the will of any people if they wake up. Once the people wake up, they just go forward. And this is what's happened here and what's happening in the region, and it's going to happen in the world. And as we say in the Quran, in the Holy Quran, إِذَا جَاءَ نَصْرُ اللَّهِ وَالْفَتْحِ وَرَأَيْتَ النَّاسِ يَدْخُلُونَ فِي دِينِ اللَّهِ أَفْوَاجًا. When God's victory and support comes, you see that people enter the right path in large groups. Mm-hmm. So this revolution started here, then this region was under the impact of this revolution, then other countries, and this is what the leaders of America see, and they cannot come with a tactic to control it. Well, they've been planning and plotting, all right? They've been trying to limit Iran and sanction Iran and make, you know, problems within Iran and right. in our society and community here, like what they did in other countries. But no matter what they did, the people of Iran and the leadership here were together, and they fought against them, and they won.
Well, I mean, if we look at the situation and we go back to, we look at the world post World War II, 1945 and afterwards, and basically divided into the two spheres. Either a country was under the Soviet bloc or under the United States, one or the other. No independence. And then in 1979, this situation happens. And Imam says, not east, not west, mm-hmm. But the way to Islam, the path to Islam. So it was a major blow to these imperialist powers to offer a different path. This had never happened in the way. It was either communism or capitalism, neoliberalism. That's it. There was no choice. Imam came and he says, no, there is another choice. And this is the best choice, and this is the way. So that affected them very much so. And would you say that from the very beginning, the least that we can say, that Iran was very much a thorn in their side that came out of the blue? They did not expect it, because they had their plans, they had divided the world into these two spheres, and then Iran comes and starts influencing and having that effect. And I want to look at that and in the way that they still deal with Iran today. One could say that it appears that they never got over that blow. How do you see it?
And see, as you beautifully stated, Imam Khomeini, when he started his revolution, he said, we're not going to rely on the Eastern powers, nor are we going to rely on the Western powers. We're going to rely on the power of our people, our fighting for independence. Imam Khomeini sent a letter to the Soviet Union and told them, and he predicted that you're going to fall very soon. You're going to lose power very soon in the near future. They didn't believe it because they had their plans. They thought everything is going to, you know, go by their plans. As it is the case today, that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, he told them that you're going to lose power and you're declining and you're going down. They did not expect this power, the power of the people, to come up all of a sudden and mess up their plan and destroy their plans and plots. The first block is down. The second block is also going down and declining. Everybody says this. Those who are closely watching and preserving what's going on in America, the Americans themselves, they know that the post-American era is going to start, and or maybe it has already begun and started. And America has lost that hegemony and that power that they had. And it's all because of the result of this, not all because of the result of this revolution, but it's also because of the oppression they had to their own people as well. But Imam did not rely on the Eastern powers, nor the Western powers. The Eastern power is gone. The Western power will be gone soon as well. And the people of the world will know that the only thing that they can rely on is their own power, their own will. Imam Khomeini, this is one of the things that he says, that we have to make a government in the world where people can exercise freedom and express their ideas freely. Today they talk about the freedom of speech and the freedom of expression. Do we really have this? Through the power of their propaganda, they put whatever they want in the in people's minds. This is what the West and East Bloc are afraid of. And, well, we're trying to push away what they say, push away the propaganda, the pressure of their propaganda media on the people, and let them think for themselves. Mm-hmm. Think. See your life, see your future, see your destination, see who your friend and your enemy are.
And perhaps that's the most frightening aspect of it all for them.
Yes.
I really appreciate you being with me and starting off our coverage today of the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Sheikh Mahdi Taib, from the founder of the Al-Qa'im Seminary in Qom. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was an honor being with you guys.
And viewers, thanks so much for staying with us as we continue our coverage this on the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. I'm going to send it back up to my colleague. Stay with us.
Thank you very much, Marzia, for that all-inclusive and comprehensive discussion that you had with Sheikh Mahdi Taib. I really appreciate it. We're going to move on with the coverage of today's events and, of course, you know what happened 42 years ago. For this part of the program, before I move on with my own guests, I'm going to draw your attention to a report that Press TV has prepared for you. Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was the face, the architect of Iran's Islamic Revolution. He helped found and led Iran's anti-monarchy movement that brought one of the most successful revolutions in history. Imam Khomeini was a highly admired person who dedicated his life to serving the people of Iran. Here's a brief report on his life. Take a look, please.
Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in 1902 in the central Iranian town of Khomein into a family with a strong religious background. After World War I, young Ruhollah went to the city of Arak to study in its Islamic seminary. He was placed under the leadership of Ayatollah Abdul Karim Ha'eri Yazdi. The following year, Ayatollah Ha'eri Yazdi transferred to the Islamic seminary in the holy city of Qom and invited his students to follow. Khomeini's studies included Islamic law and jurisprudence. He was also drawn to the relationship between politics and religion, in particular the role of the clergy in politics. In his conversations with religious scholars and leaders, he raised the issue of saving Iran and safeguarding Islam. He believed the Iranian people needed to overthrow the ruling Pahlavi dynasty to be freed. Ruhollah Khomeini became a lecturer at Najaf and Qom seminaries, teaching political philosophy, Islamic history, and ethics. He soon became a leading scholar of Shia Islam, and his hostility towards Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, more commonly known as the Shah, began to receive wider attention. He became the main opposition speaker inside Iran, constantly attacking the monarch's brutality. He warned the Shah that if he didn't change, the day would come when people would offer up thanks for his departure from the country. Following these comments that prompted massive protests in Qom, Khomeini was arrested and exiled in June 1963. After spending 2 years in Turkey, he returned to Najaf in Iraq, where he continued his sermons as well as his attacks on the Shah, showing that exile could not silence him. His followers created a complex network in which they carried the tape recordings of his speeches to Iran, where new copies would be made and distributed in mosques throughout the country. Imam Khomeini became the face of the opposition to Iran's ruling elite, both inside and outside the country. The more influence and followers the scholar gained, the less secure the authorities in Tehran felt. Eventually, the Shah's government called for help and Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, who expelled Imam Khomeini from the country. In October 1978, the Imam went to Paris and stayed in the town of Neufel-le-Château. At the time, the streets of Tehran were flooded by mass anti-Shah protesters inspired by Imam Khomeini. In January 1979, the Shah was forced to flee into exile. For the next 2 weeks, the country was preparing for the Imam's return to his country after 16 years. The world witnessed a historic event as an unprecedented crowd greeted Imam Khomeini on his return. Millions lined up in the streets chanting his name and followed his car as he went to Tehran's famous cemetery of Behesht Zahra, where he made his historic address. The revolution was complete.
Well, that report by itself showed it is totally justified to think that a lot of people say Imam Khomeini rewrote history books. I'm going to bring in some guests to discuss the different aspects of that. But before we did that, let me just tell you that images that you're watching for yourselves on your screens are live from the southern city of Bandar Abbas, which sees on one of its main streets, I believe, motorcycles of people who had wanted to take part in this year's ceremonies. Before I move on, let me just remind you something. Before COVID-19 hit, the streets of the cities of Iran witnessed a large number of people, participants in rallies and not demonstrations, but marches and rallies that culminated usually in a speech by a high-ranking official in Tehran. We used to have the president normally doing this in order to show the feelings and perhaps, you know, the ceremony that is naturally held on the day of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and its anniversary, of course. But this year, because of COVID-19, the government, the establishment, has asked people, those participants, to either be in their cars or on their motorcycles if they want to participate in this year's rallies. And that is why you see those people on those motorcycles holding the Iranian flag. We're going to take you to the northeastern city of Mashhad, the holy city of Mashhad. The reason why you see that traffic jam, it's not a traffic jam because obviously because of this day, it is a national holiday. People are not out there on business. People in their cars are participating in the rally merely due to the fact that they want to observe that social distancing measure which is needed for the time of COVID-19. So what you see on your screens is not a traffic jam, people. It's the nation, it's the people's cars and ordinary people in them participating in this year's rally, which, as I said, because of COVID-19, is being held that way. That is the city of Mashhad in northeast of Iran. Just moments ago, we just brought you live images from the city of Bandar Abbas. Now, as soon as we have images coming in from other Iranian cities, I'm going to let you know. Now, as you're watching those images for yourself, I'm going to bring in my guests to little by little start our discussions with them about that report that you just watched about the Islamic Revolution. And, of course, most notably, the role that Imam Khomeini played in bringing the victory about in that, bringing about the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Well, esteemed guests who join me at this point of the program will be Mr. Said Mohsen Abbas. He's a journalist, political commentator, mind you, regular contributor to Press TV programs. He joins us via Skype out of London. Said, it's good to have you with us. I will also speak to Abdul Ghani Al-Khanjar. He is an activist and human rights defender who joins us via Skype out of Tehran. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. I'm going to begin with Sayed in London to discuss with us, tell us a little bit, Sayed, about the role that just package that I just aired right now was speaking about the role that Imam Khomeini played in the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Sayed.
Well, I think without the role of Imam Khomeini within the revolution, it's quite difficult to see how all the disparate forces which were involved in the run-up from 1977, and let's take it just from that point, let's not go back to the time of the early, if you like, uprisings, which Imam Khomeini was exiled for in 63 onwards. We see that there were so many different forces. There were communists, there were socialists, there were sorts of people from the middle classes. It was a revolution which was absolutely shocking to the rest of the world because it broke all the rules of revolutions. It wasn't the underclass which was rising up to overthrow an upper class, if you like. It was simply the whole of the Islamic Republic of Iran's, Iran's population at that time saying they'd had enough of an imperialist rule, and they all came together. Imam Khomeini was at the, if you like, eye of this storm. And it's really his character, his personality, his commitment to not only the idea of taking down imperialism, or imperialism as manifested by the Shah at that time, but also his own personality, his own character, his own attachment to mysticism, his own personal, if you like, etiquette and living in a very simple, very humble, very pious manner, which the Iranian people had seen, and they knew him well. They knew of this honesty and integrity. That honesty and integrity really allowed all of these forces to galvanize around around him in a way and to trust him. And he, in a sense, utilized that trust to and that kind of holistic personal character and the sacrifice that he'd personally made to keep the nation as galvanized as possible. Of course, after a very relatively bloodless revolution, we found that there was a kickback, and some of these forces who didn't agree totally with Imam Khomeini and his vision, did start creating terrorist activities. Many Iranian lives were lost. And again, it was Imam Khomeini who really pulled together Iran in that aftermath, the responses to that terrorism, the response to the invasion by Iraq at the behest of Zio imperialist forces to try and bring down the Islamic Revolution, to bring down Iran's independence and sovereignty. So every step of the way, you have to really acknowledge the role and the character and the piety and the actual connection with the Iranian people that Imam Khomeini had.
All right, let's discuss the same thing with Abdul Ghani Al-Khanjar in Tehran. It's good to have you with us, too. Tell me what you think about this. You know, a lot of people, Abdul Ghani, were saying, you know, before 63 that Sayed just mentioned, it would be hard to imagine for a clergy to basically garner this much support that more than a decade later reached the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Such an unbelievable story if you could tell people before 63 that in a few years this would happen. In what way do you describe the role that Imam Khomeini played in bringing about the victory of the Islamic Revolution?
First of all, thank you very much, and greeting you and your guest. And I thank Press TV for this great opportunity to participate in this great occasion and special occasion. First, let me congratulate the people of Iran and the entire Islamic world on this occasion, the 42nd of anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And let me start from what Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmad Qasim said recently in his statement about this revolution. He said that he described the revolution as a great dawn coming after long night. I think so, that the revolution or the Islamic Revolution of Iran wasn't only a down for Iranians, but also it is also a down for all oppressed and deprived people in the world. Imam Khomeini was a great Ayatollah. Imam Khomeini, he was a great leader. I think that Imam Khomeini focused on Islam, focused on to overthrow the Pahlavi regime, who was backed by the U.S. and the Western power. And Imam Khomeini, because he was a very unique leader, he started his struggle against the Pahlavi regime, and he bought a clear objective. So after decades of struggling, that objective came to the reality, and the revolution completed.
Sure. Okay, I'm going to return to Sayed Mohsen. Sayed Mohsen, of course, you know, one of the main lines of discussion when you discuss the role that Imam Khomeini played, you know, one cannot forget mentioning the legacy that he has left behind. Not only, I would argue, in Iran, if not the whole world, at least our region has been very much affected. And that's not what I say, that's what has been said by many scholars and many thinkers over the years, especially after the Iranian Revolution, and of course the change that it brought about with itself. By the way, before I go back to Sayed, just moments ago you watched another city in Iran, Shahrekord, that is witnessing its own share of today's rallies. Yes, Sayed. So the legacy, and of course the role Imam Khomeini played in all that, and I said not only in Iran, but throughout the West Asia region. To what extent would you agree with the arguments that it was far from the, and much outside the borders of Iran, the outreach of what Imam Khomeini did with the revolution, and of course the victory of the revolution in Iran? How do you comment on that?
Well, I mean, people here in Britain, myself, where I live, we were very aware of what was happening in Iran. We watched the events very closely, and it was a period of when Muslims around the world were very much conscious of their own downtrodden nature. Don't forget, colonialism had only just left most of the Muslim world,